with Mahmoud Khalil and others calling for an arms embargo against Israel. Explain.
Yeah, well, first of all, Israel is committing a genocide, and I think it's indefensible for anyone to, in this moment, try to make an excuse of what's happening and allowing it to happen under our watch. I have a bill. It's a specific concrete bill that blocks bombs to Israel. It is one of the first bills in its nature where now we have 47 members of Congress who have joined the bill, and it says we are going to withhold weapons. We're not going to allow Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu to just easily make a transfer of these weapons that we know have violated international law and killed babies. This afternoon, I will be having a deep discussion with a number of my colleagues, calling for them directly in a meeting, urging them to join this bill immediately and bring it to a committee hearing in armed services in the jurisdiction of the bill.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Kevin Herrera, in the lawsuit that your plaintiffs filed, they talked about as well the way that Venezuelans were singled out by these off-duty police, that they picked up the Venezuelans and beat them and had them arrested, but not other day laborers. Could you talk about that as well?
Yes, that's correct. Based on the facts that we've heard from each of our plaintiffs, the off-duty police officers and Home Depot security who dragged those individuals into the back of the Home Depot and abused them also used nationalist epithets regarding their ethnicity, specifically accusing them of being Venezuelan, of being recent arrivals, of being someone that the government didn't want there. One of our clients, who's Colombian, told them that he was Colombian, and they said he was lying and proceeded to hit him again. So with William, one of the saddest facts of his case is that he was profiled initially during the first trauma that he experienced at the Home Depot. And now, over a year later, he's been profiled again via the ways in which ICE is selecting people based on the color of their skin, based on their language and how they speak it. Whether they speak with an accent, and here, apparently, based on their ability to speak out and call out injustice and racism in the United States, William was double profiled, and now he's suffering consequences within the ICE detention system after he'd already been through so much at the Home Depot.
Kevin Herrera, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to follow this case. Legal director of Raise the Floor Alliance. He's an attorney for William Jimenez Gonzalez, speaking to us from Chicago. And thank you also to Congressmember Delia Ramirez of Chicago, the first Latina congressmember to represent Illinois. And this sad news just in, the acclaimed Oscar-winning actor Robert Redford died early this morning at his home in Utah. He was 89 years old. He founded the Sundance Film Festival, which will be for the last time in Utah this next year, and then move on to Boulder. Again, the Oscar-winning director and actor Robert Redford has died at the age of 89. To see all of our interviews with Robert Redford at Democracy Now! As we attended the Sundance Film Festival over the years, go to democracynow.org. Coming up, Reverend William Barber talking about the assassination of Charlie Kirk, Christian nationalism, and more. Stay with us.
The forsaken got no reason to cry. You got to chew the angels falling from on high, waiting for no answer, baking woeful pie. Pie of eyesight, pie blue black. Oh, that pie, the pie of bye-bye. The forsaken, he will leave you one more chance, which if you won't be taken, he'll leave it for the ants. Sings out in the wilderness, sings for friend and foe, he sings of these and those times as well as the times to go.
Hog of the Forsaken by the late folk legend Michael Hurley, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Prosecutors are expected to file charges today in the murder case of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, who was fatally shot last week during a campus event at Utah Valley University. The alleged shooter, 22-year-old Tyler Robinson of Utah, is currently in custody and may be facing the death penalty. He'll be arraigned today. Charlie Kirk was a well-known figure in the MAGA movement, a close ally of President Trump. Through his organization, Turning Points USA, he's credited with mobilizing young conservative voters, expanding Republican turnout in 2024. He also reached a wide audience with his podcast, The Charlie Kirk Show. Kirk strongly identified as a Christian and didn't believe in the separation of church and state. This is Kirk speaking in 2022.
Of course, we should have church and state mixed together. Our founding fathers believed in that. We can go through the details of that. They established literally a church in Congress.
While the motives for the murder are not known at this time, President Trump and his allies are accusing the political left of fomenting violence. President Trump was questioned about this by a reporter at the White House yesterday.
Given the killing of Melissa Horton, the attack on Paul Pelosi, the attack on Gabby Giffords, the attack on the Pennsylvania governor's mansion, why make the case that violence is only on one side? It seems to be taking...
I didn't say it's on one side, but I say the radical left causes tremendous violence, and they seem to do it in a bigger way. But the radical left really has caused a lot of problems for this country. I really think they hate our country.
Last year, a unit of the Department of Justice published a major study on domestic terrorism. It found, quote, since 1990, far-right extremists have committed far more ideologically motivated homicides than far-left or radical Islamist extremists, unquote. The DOJ removed the study after the Charlie Kirk killing. For more, we're joined by Bishop William Barber, president of Repairers of the Breach and founding director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School, also national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign and leader of the Moral Mondays movement, co-author of the book White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy, joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome to Democracy Now!, your response to the assassination of Charlie Kirk, Bishop Barber.
I paused for a minute, Amy, because of the last statement that you made where you said that they removed the study where the facts did not line up with the narrative that the president, Stephen Miller, and others were seeking to put out. And I just had to, I'll come back to that, but I just had to stop for a moment. I want people to hear that who are listening in. You know, this past week, there was a brutal on-camera assassination of Brother Charlie Kirk, and we must all despise it. As one, I've known what it means to live with people who send you threats and want to see your demise. And because we're human beings, we should despise violence against any other human being. We should despise that it left him dead, his wife broken, heartbroken, without a husband, his children, without a father. And all of us should be bothered. All of us should denounce political violence and pray for the family and stand against this viciousness and violence, murder. We've had too much. Just yesterday, we had a Moral Monday on September 15th, remembering that after the March on Washington, 17 days afterwards, four girls were blown up in a church in Birmingham, what they called Bumingham at that time, with a white supremacist trying to stop the civil rights movement. And Dr. King said at that time, he raised the issue of not just who killed her, but what killed her. And so we should all be deeply moved, deeply bothered. But here's the other side, Amy, and to your audience. If you didn't get bothered by political death until the other day, this must be challenged too. The prophets in the Bible and even in the Jesus in the New Testament, they talk about how our trouble in nations is rooted in political violence. So if you're bothered by what happened last week, you can't be quiet and not cry out against what happened to some politicians earlier this year in Minnesota. If you're bothered by that kind of what happened last week, you have to cry out also against the 800 people who die every day from poverty and over 200 and some thousand who die every year from policies that cause violence among the poor. You have to cry out against the hundreds of thousands that die needlessly during the height of COVID and still die from the lack of health care. The lack of health care in a nation where politicians in the middle of a pandemic refuse to ensure health care. And one study says over 350,000 people died not from COVID, but from the lack of health care. You have to cry out against any kind of political violence. You have to cry out against the violence perpetrated against the homeless and accented by policies that say lock them up rather than build housing, or when a Fox News host says just kill them, just give them a lethal injection. You have to cry out against threats of political violence in all of its form. The president saying, I can stand in the middle of the Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and I wouldn't lose any followers. You have to stand against the violence we see happening in Gaza and the Congo and Yemen. America has been facing a turning point in this society for some time. And the question is, when will America say, that death is and violence is no longer an option? Not just that happened, as terrible as it was. We have to have a real, real serious moral debate about political violence in this nation.
Reverend Barber, I wanted to ask you, during a recent speech at a Senator Bernie Sanders rally in North Carolina, you called Christian nationalism, quote, heresy by another name. Could you talk about that?
Well, the reason I called it is because of what the scriptures say. If you go to the ancient scripture, Isaiah 58, is lifted up by Jews, Muslims, and Christians. It says that the kind of religion, the kind of fasting that God requires is not just saying that everybody pray. I'm paraphrasing. It says the kind of religion that the Lord wants is to speak truth to the nation, to tell the nation its sin, to cry out against oppression, against paying people less than what they deserve, against those things that hurt and cause more homelessness. Throughout the scriptures, there are more than 2,000 scriptures. You go to the New Testament, it says a nation will be judged by how you treat the least of these. And what happens with so-called religious nationalism is that it attempts to lift the flag above the cross. It attempts to suggest that one political side or one political party or one political framework is in fact God's way, when in fact the scriptures are clear about that. And what heresy is when you take something that is truth and you try to twist it, when you try to twist faith to support political violence, when you try to twist faith to give you the right to denounce even those who are trying to live out the call of love and justice. And this is not the first time we've had a debate with a kind of religious nationalism. Religious nationalism was what undergirded the slave masters. They created a religion that said that slavery was all right. It was the kind of religious nationalism that was formed to come against Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he called for the New Deal. There was a religious nationalism that came against Dr. King and many others who were standing up for civil rights. We've always had this debate in this nation, and really we need to have it even the more today. Because on the one hand, you cannot claim that you believe in a God and a Christ of love and justice and mercy and grace and truth, and then you push policies that prey, P-R-E-Y, on the very persons and the very communities that the scriptures, that the example of Jesus and the prophet tells us we should not only pray for, P-R-A-Y for, but we should also be lifting up and helping up and protecting.
On Monday, Vice President J.D. Vance hosted the Charlie Kirk Show and interviewed Stephen Miller, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy at the White House. Vance asked Miller to elaborate on how the administration would be working to prevent what he called the, quote, festering violence that you see on the far left in reference to the assassination of Kirk.
We are going to channel all of the anger that we have over the organized campaign that led to this assassination to uproot and dismantle these terrorist networks. So let me explain a little bit what that means. So
You've got 30 seconds. So be quick, Stephen.
The organized doxing campaigns, the organized riots, the organized street violence, the organized campaigns of dehumanization, vilification, posting people's addresses, combining that with messaging that's designed to trigger incite violence, and the actual organized cells that carry out and facilitate the violence, it is a vast domestic terror movement. And with God as my witness, we are going to use every resource we have at the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and throughout this government to identify, disrupt, dismantle, and destroy these networks and make America safe again for the American people. It will happen, and we will do it in Charlie's name.
So that was Stephen Miller talking to J.D. Vance, who was hosting Charlie Kirk's daily podcast because Kirk was assassinated. We just have 30 seconds, Bishop Barber. But as they talk about the left as terrorists and taking down the network in Charlie's name, can you respond?
Three things real quickly. First of all, when people of faith or Christian, we're supposed to do things in Jesus' name, not in somebody's name. And that Jesus would not be doing what he's talking about there. Secondly, you just said at the beginning of the program that they had documentation of what's really going on, factual evidence, and they removed it from the website because they don't want to deal with the truth. And instead, they want to use a tragic, violent death that all of us are, should be against and should be concerned about, and use that to stoke more division, possibly more violence, more ugliness. And that is wrong. It is undemocratic. It is unjust. And it does not line up with their oath to establish justice, to promote the common defense, to promote the general welfare, and to ensure domestic tranquility and equal protection under the law. What Steve Miller should be working on is stop terrorizing immigrants, stop pushing policies of health care that are going to cause people to prematurely die, stop being against living wages, and stop trying to undermine equal protection under the law. That's what we ought to be doing, and we ought to do that in the name of all that is holy and good and gracious, and we ought to do it in line with our deepest political, constitutional values and our deepest faith values.
Bishop William Barber, I want to thank you so much for being with us. President Repairers at the Breach, National Co-Chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Coming up, President Trump announces the U.S. bombed another Venezuelan boat, killing three people. Stay with us.
I'm just an American boy, raised on MTV. I seen all them kids and soda pop ads. None of them look like me. So I started looking around for light out of the dim. First thing I heard that made sense was the word with Muhammad, peace be upon him. Ashhadu la ilaha illallah. There's no God.
John Walker's Blues by Steve Earle, performing at Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Monday, President Trump announced the U.S. bombed another boat in international waters near Venezuela, this time killing three people. He claimed the targeted boat was carrying drugs from Venezuela, posted video of a speedboat erupting in flames from an apparent airstrike. 2 weeks ago, the U.S. bombed another boat in the region, killing 11 people. Trump also claimed that boat was carrying drugs, though some have speculated the passengers, 11 people on board, may simply have been migrants. In a third incident, the U.S. Navy recently raided a fishing boat in Venezuelan waters. Personnel from a U.S. warship reportedly boarded the boat, then detained nine fishermen for 8 hours. The escalating U.S. military action against Venezuela comes after President Trump signed a secret directive approving the Pentagon's use of military force in Latin America, supposedly to target drug cartels. On Monday, War Secretary Pete Hegseth issued a warning to drug cartels, writing on X, quote, "We will track them, kill them, dismantle their networks throughout our hemisphere at the times and places of our choosing," Hegseth wrote. In recent weeks, the U.S. has sent multiple warships to the Caribbean. The U.S. military has also been carrying out military exercises in Puerto Rico. Last week, Hegseth and Air Force General Dan Kane, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, made a surprise visit to Puerto Rico. Trump has also ordered the deployment of 10 F-35 fighter jets to Puerto Rico. We go now to California, where we're joined by Miguel Tinker Salas, Emeritus Professor of History at Pomona College in Claremont, California, the author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Society in Venezuela, as well as the book Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. Professor Miguel Tinker Salas, welcome back to Democracy Now! What does everyone need to know about one attack after another on Venezuelan boats, at this point killing, 11 people in the last few weeks?
Well, we have a very clear example of political theater, an attempt at provocation, an ongoing effort at regime change, and the strategy of trying to use the military to interdict drug trafficking, which has failed incredibly in Mexico, Colombia, everywhere else the U.S. has applied it. So if we look at this in the context of what's going on right now, underscoring most of it is attempt at regime change, some tensions within the White House or within the administration between realists who want to actually engage with Venezuela and exchange oil, as we saw with the Chevron license, and others led by Marco Rubio, who have taken us back to the Cold War and violent regime change in Latin America.
And Miguel, could you talk about particularly the role of Rubio in this? Because obviously with two top posts, a Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, he is a very influential person in the Trump administration. Obviously this doubling of the reward for Maduro and the accusations by the U.S. government that he's the head of the so-called Cartel de los Soles, it reminds us all of what happened with Noriega decades ago in Panama.
Well, it also reminds me of Iraq and again, the whole notion of weapons of mass destruction that weren't there. In Venezuela, the use of Cartel de los Soles can actually be traced back to 1993 and the role the CIA played in trafficking over a ton of cocaine from Venezuela with several Venezuelan generals before Chavez into the U.S. as an effort to try to track Colombian cartels, which was a complete failure. And again, it reminds us that Marco Rubio plays a fundamental role because he also represents in large part the Venezuelan opposition in South Florida. And here we have a case of someone like Ahmed Chalabi in the case of Iraq informing in U.S. policy, indicating that there's going to be pressure or an explosion in Venezuela if Trump does these actions. And it hasn't happened. But they are nonetheless looking for cracks within the Venezuelan military. They're looking for fissures. But Rubio plays a key role as an interlocutor between the right wing in Venezuela and the U.S. administration in an effort at violent regime change.
I wanted to ask you as well about these attacks on boats. The first boat that was attacked where 11 people were reportedly killed. There have been reports in the New York Times and other media that this boat had actually turned around and was headed back after it noticed that there was a U.S. planes were tailing it. Your response to these, in essence, extrajudicial killings?
Well, this is, again, where the Trump administration established itself as judge, jury, and executioner. There is always a lot of traffic between Sucre, the state of Sucre in Venezuela, and the island of Trinidad. Many of these individuals were trafficking between the two countries. To think that drug traffickers are going to put 11 people on a boat where that space is critical for actually trafficking other materials, illegal materials, or drugs is absurd. So more than likely, they were trafficking undocumented immigrants going to Trinidad, as they have historically since the 18th and 19th century. So in this context, it was an extrajudiciary killing where there's been no evidence. And even if there was evidence that the case of trafficking does not merit execution, as the Coast Guard has done in previous occasions, they interdict, they board the ship, they arrest the individuals, they provide the evidence. Here we have no evidence. And the notion that trafficking from Venezuela is it runs against the very notion that the U.S. military assessment of April of 2025, where it said that less than 5 to 7% of drug trafficking occurs through Venezuela. While Trump is putting the military in the Caribbean Sea, most of drug trafficking, over 90%, takes place in the Pacific. So it's illogical to think that a flotilla off the coast of Venezuela is going to stop drug trafficking, whether it's cocaine or otherwise. And again, to Trump's point yesterday, Venezuela does not have a source of fentanyl. Fentanyl is the domain of the Mexican cartels. So again, he is misleading the population, he's misleading the public, and indicating that these were drug traffickers with no evidence whatsoever.
And finally, your assessment of the continued claim of the United States that this the so-called gang in Venezuela, Tren de Aragua, is a terrorist organization?
Well, I think that calling drug traffickers or any gang terrorists has a political purpose. If you label them terrorists, then you lay the groundwork for a political intervention, military intervention, or an effort at regime change. We saw that in the case of Panama. We saw that in the case of other countries. We saw that debated in Mexico, where Trump told Mark Espers that he wanted to launch cruise missiles into narco laboratories. Again, the notion of attacking a sovereign country, attacking its citizens, is contrary to international law, to the law of the sea, and it's a direct violation of principles held for over several decades.
I mean, a judge recently ruled that because we're not at war with Venezuela, they can't just wholesale the Trump administration, deport or remove Venezuelans. Do you think that President Trump is trying to provoke Venezuela into doing something so the U.S. will be at war? And do you see this as a distraction, perhaps from the Epstein files or whatever President Trump doesn't want to us to focus on at home?
I wrote about that in an op-ed last week with a colleague in La Jornada, in which we argued that the loss at the Fifth District Court puts the Trump administration in a bind. They want to deport 650,000 Venezuelans. They use the Enemy Aliens Act as the pretext. The court rejected it. So now he has the choice of going back to the Fifth District or the Supreme Court. It's a case of Wag the Dog. If we all remember the movie in 1997, where you create a war, you create a conflict in order to distract attention from what's happening in the U.S. So there is a national component, a U.S. component to this conflict. There's a Venezuelan component, but they dovetail nicely around the issue of the deportations. As Trump seeks to distract attention from the Epstein case and from the economy and from other issues that are occurring in the U.S.
Finally, Vice President J.D. Vance dismissed accusations that the first attack on the boat that killed 11 people may have been a war crime if civilians were on board. Vance wrote on X, "I don't give a," rhymes with hit, "what you think," he said. "I don't give a what you call it," using the expletive. He was responding to Republican Senator Rand Paul criticizing Vance's comments, saying what a despicable and thoughtless sentiment it is to glorify killing someone without a trial. You have 10 seconds, Professor Tinker Salas.
Again, the U.S. puts itself above the law, above international law, and places itself as a judge, jury, and executioner without ever providing any evidence.
Professor Miguel Tinker Salas, Emeritus Professor of History at Pomona College in Claremont, California. You can go to our website for our interview with him in Spanish at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Communication is everywhere, but what is it? Communication is how you share your thoughts, your opinions, your culture, from what you see on TV to what you post online. But what about the people who are not being seen or heard? AMI is a media company that strives to be a voice for Canadians with disabilities, whether it's through positive portrayal, reflection, and accessible media. AMI believes everyone should be included, and that includes you. AMI is inclusion. Experience AMI at amiplus.ca.